I smiled to show I was teasing her, but she buried her face into her drink, came back up pink and resolute.
"Stay as long as you want, Camille, really," she said. "But you will have to be kind to your sister. Those girls were her schoolmates."
"I look forward to getting to know her," I mumbled. "I'm very sorry for her loss." The last words I couldn't resist, but my mother didn't notice their bitter spin.
"I'll give you the bedroom next to the sitting room. Your old bedroom. It has a tub. I'll buy fresh fruit and some toothpaste. And steaks. Do you eat steak?"
4 hours of threadbare sleep, like lying in a bathtub with your ears half submerged. Shooting up in bed every 20 minutes, my heart pounding so hard I wondered if it was the beating that woke me. I dreamt I was packing for a trip, then realized I'd laid out all the wrong clothes, sweaters for a summer vacation. I dreamt I'd filed the wrong story for Curry before I left. Instead of the item on miserable Tammy Davis and her 4 locked-up children, we'd run a puff piece about skin care. I dreamt my mother was slicing an apple onto thick cuts of meat and feeding it to me, slowly and sweetly, because I was dying. Just after 5 a.m., I finally threw off the covers. I washed Anne's name off my arm, but somehow, between dressing, brushing my hair, and dabbing on some lipstick, I'd written Natalie Keene in its place. I decided to leave it for luck. Outside, the sun was just rising, but my car handle was already hot. My face felt numb from lack of sleep, and I stretched my eyes and mouth wide like a B-movie scream queen. The search party was set to reconvene at 6 a.m. for continued work in the woods. I wanted to catch a quote from Vickery before the day began. Staking out the police station seemed a good bet. Main Street looked vacant at first, but as I got out of my car, I could see 2 people a few blocks down. It was a scene that made no sense. An older woman was sitting in the middle of the sidewalk, legs splayed, staring at the side of a building, while a man was stooped over her. The woman was shaking her head manically, like a child refusing to feed. Her legs shot out at angles that had to hurt her. A bad fall? Heart attack, maybe? I walked briskly toward them and could hear their staccato murmuring. The man, white hair and ruined face, looked up at me with milky eyes.
"Get the police," he said. His voice came out crumpled. "And call an ambulance."
"What's wrong?" I started. But then I saw it. Wedged in the foot-wide space between the hardware store and the beauty parlor was a tiny body aimed out at the sidewalk. As if she were just sitting and waiting for us, brown eyes wide open. I recognized the wild curls. But the grin was gone. Natalie Keene's lips caved in around her gums in a small circle. She looked like a plastic baby doll, the kind with a built-in hole for bottle feedings. Natalie had no teeth now. The blood hit my face fast, and a shimmer of sweat quickly covered my skin. My legs and arms went slack, and for a second I thought I might smack the ground right next to the woman, who was now quietly praying. I backed up, leaned against a parked car, and put my fingers to my neck, willing my thumping pulse to slow. My eyes picked up images in meaningless flashes. The grimy rubber tip of the old man's cane, a pink mole on the back of the woman's neck, the band-aid on Natalie Keene's knee. I could feel her name glowing hotly under my shirt sleeve. Then more voices, and Chief Vickery was running toward us with a man.
"God damn it!"
Vickery grunted when he saw her.
"God damn it, Jesus!"
He put his face against the brick of the beauty parlor and breathed hard. The second man, about my age, stooped next to Natalie.
A loop of bruised purple circled her neck, and he pressed his fingers just above it to check for a pulse. A stalling tactic while he gathered his composure. The child was clearly dead. Big shot detective from Kansas City, I guessed. The smug kid. He was good, though, coaxing the woman out of her prayers and into a calm story of the discovery. The two were husband and wife, the owners of the diner whose name I couldn't remember the day before. Broussard. They were on their way to open for breakfast when they found her. They'd been there maybe 5 minutes before I came along. A uniformed officer arrived, pulled his hands over his face when he saw what he'd been called for. "Folks, we're gonna need you to head to the station with the officer here so we can get some statements," Kansas City said. "Bill." His voice had a parental sternness to it. Vickery was kneeling by the body, motionless. His lips moved as if he might be praying, too. His name had to be repeated twice before he snapped back.
"I hear you, Richard. Be human for a second."
Bill Vickery put his arms around Mrs. Broussard and murmured to her until she patted his hand. I sat in a room the color of egg yolk for 2 hours while the officer got my story down. The whole time I was thinking about Natalie going to autopsy and how I would like to sneak in and put a fresh Band-Aid on her knee. Chapter 3. My mother was wearing blue to the funeral. Black was hopeless, and any other color was indecent. She also wore blue to Marion's funeral, and so did Marion. She was astonished I didn't remember this. I remembered Marion being buried in a pale pink dress. This was no surprise. My mother and I generally differ on all things concerning my dead sister. The morning of the service, Adora clicked in and out of rooms on her heels, here spraying perfume, there fastening an earring. I watched and drank hot black coffee with a burnt tongue. "I don't know them well," she was saying. "They really kept to themselves, but I feel all the community should support them. Natalie was such a darling. People were so kind to me when..." Wistful downward glance. It may have been genuine. I had been in Wind Gap 5 days, and Amma was still an unseen presence. My mother didn't mention her. I'd also failed so far to get a quote from the Keens. Nor had I gotten permission from the family to attend the funeral, but Curry wanted that coverage more than I'd ever heard him want anything, and I wanted to prove I could handle this. I figured the Keens would never find out. No one reads our paper. Murmured greetings and perfumed hugs at Our Lady of Sorrows, a few women nodding politely at me after they cooed over my mother, so brave of Adora to come, and shoved down to make room for her. Our Lady of Sorrows is a shiny 70s Catholic church, bronzy gold and bejeweled, like a dime store ring. Wind Gap is a tiny holdout of Catholicism in a region of booming Southern Baptists, the town having been founded by a pack of Irish. All the McMahons and Malones landed in New York during the potato famine, got generously abused, and, if they were smart, headed west. The French already reigned in St. Louis, so they turned south and started their own towns. But they were unceremoniously pushed out years later during Reconstruction. Missouri, always a conflicted place, was trying to shed its southern roots, reinvent itself as a proper non-slave state, and the embarrassing Irish were swept out with other undesirables. They left their religion behind. 10 minutes till the service, and a line was forming to gain entry to the church. I surveyed the crowded seat holders inside. Something was wrong. There was not one child in the church. No boys in dark trousers rolling trucks over their mother's legs. No girls cradling rag dolls. Not a face younger than 15. I didn't know if it was out of respect for the parents or fear-driven defense. an instinct to prevent one's children from being picked as future prey. I pictured hundreds of Windgap's sons and daughters tucked away in dark den rooms, sucking the backs of their hands while they watched TV and remained unmarked. Without kids to tend to, the churchgoers seemed static, like paperboard cutouts holding the places of real people. In the back, I could see Bob Nash in a dark suit. Still no wife. He nodded at me, then frowned. The organ pipes exhaled the muffled tones of Be Not Afraid, and Natalie Keene's family, until then crying and hugging and fussing near the door like one massive failing heart, filed tightly together. Only two men were needed to carry the shiny white coffin. Any more, and they would have been bumping into each other. Natalie's mother and father led the procession. She was 3 inches taller than he, a large, warm-looking woman with sandy hair held back with a headband. She had an open face, the kind that would prompt strangers to ask for directions or the time. Mr. Keene was small and thin, with a round child's face made rounder by wire spectacles that looked like two gold bike wheels. Behind them walked a beautiful boy of 18 or 19, his brunette head bowed into his chest, sobbing. Natalie's brother, a woman whispered behind me. Tears ran down my mother's cheeks and dripped loudly onto the leather purse she held in her lap. The woman next to her patted her hand. I slipped my notepad from my jacket pocket and began scribbling notes to one side until my mother slapped her hand on mine and hissed, "You are being disrespectful and embarrassing. Stop, or I will make you leave." I quit writing but kept the pad out, feeling stabbingly defiant, but still blushing. The procession moved past us. The coffin seemed ludicrously small. I pictured Natalie inside and could see her legs again. Downy hair, knobby knees, the band-aid. I ached once, hard, like a period typed at the end of a sentence. As the priest murmured the opening prayers in his best vestments, and we stood and sat and stood again, prayer cards were distributed. On the front, the Virgin Mary beamed her bright red heart down on baby Jesus. On the back was printed, "Natalie Jane Keene, darling daughter, sister, and friend. Heaven has a new angel." A large photo of Natalie perched near the coffin, a more formal photo than the one I'd seen before. She was a sweet, homely little thing, with a pointy chin and slightly bulbous eyes, the kind of girl who might have grown up to be strangely striking. She could have delighted men with ugly duckling stories that were actually true. Or she might have remained a sweet, homely little thing. At 10, a girl's looks are fickle. Natalie's mother made her way to the podium, clutching a piece of paper. Her face was wet, but her voice was solid when she began speaking. "This is a letter to Natalie, my only daughter." She took a shaky breath and the words streamed out. "Natalie, you are my dearest girl. I can't believe you have been taken from us. Never again will I sing you to sleep or tickle your back with my fingers. Never again will your brother get to twirl your pigtails or your father hold you on his lap. Your father will not walk you down the aisle. Your brother will never be an uncle. We will miss you at our Sunday dinners and our summer vacations. We will miss your laughter. We will miss your tears. Mostly, my dear daughter, we will miss you. We love you, Natalie." As Mrs. Keene walked back to her seat, her husband rushed up to her, but she seemed to need no steadying. As soon as she sat down, the boy was back in her arms, crying in the crook of her neck. Mr. Keene blinked angrily at the church pews behind him, as if looking for someone to hit. "It is a terrible tragedy to lose a child," intoned the priest. It is doubly terrible to lose her to such evil doings. For evil is what they are. The Bible says, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But let us not dwell on revenge. Let us think instead of what Jesus urged. Love thy neighbor. Let us be good to our neighbors in this difficult time. Lift up your hearts to God.
I like the eye for an eye stuff better, grumbled a man behind me.
I wondered if the tooth for a tooth part disturbed anyone else. When we emerged from the church into the day's glare, I could make out four girls sitting in a row along a stumpy wall across the street. Long colt legs dangling down, breasts rounded up by push-up bras. The same girls I'd run into at the edge of the forest. They were huddled together laughing until one of them, again the prettiest, motioned over at me, and they all pretended to hang their heads. Their stomachs were still jiggling, though. Natalie was buried in the family plot, next to a gravestone that already bore her parents' names. I know the wisdom, that no parents should see their child die, that such an event is like nature spun backward. But it's the only way to truly keep your child. Kids grow up. They forge more potent allegiances. They find a spouse or a lover. They will not be buried with you. The Keens, however, will remain the purest form of family. Underground. After the funeral, people gathered at the Keen home, a massive stone farmhouse, a moneyed vision of pastoral America. It was like nothing else in Wind Gap. Missouri money distances itself from bucolicry, from such country quaintness. Consider. In colonial America, wealthy women wore subtle shades of blues and grays to counter their crass New World image, while their wealthy counterparts in England tarted up like exotic birds. In short, the Keen home looked too Missouri to be owned by Missourians. The buffet table held mainly meats, turkey and ham, beef and venison. There were pickles and olives and deviled eggs, shiny hard rolls and crusted casseroles. The guests segregated themselves into two groups, the tearful and the dry. The Stoics stood in the kitchen, drinking coffee and liquor and talking about upcoming city council elections and the future of the schools, occasionally pausing to whisper angrily about the lack of progress in the murder cases.
I swear I see someone I don't know coming near my girls. I'll shoot the sumbitch before hello comes out his mouth, said one spade-faced man, flapping a roast beef sandwich. His friends nodded in agreement. I don't know why the hell Vickery hasn't emptied out the forest. Hell, raise the whole goddamn thing. You know he's in there, said a younger man with orange hair. Donnie, I'll go out there tomorrow with you, said the spade-faced man. We can just take it acre by acre. We'll find the son of a bitch. Y'all want to come?
The men muttered assents and drank more liquor from their plastic cups. I made a note to cruise past the roads near the forest in the morning to see if hangovers had given way to action or not. But I could already picture the sheepish phone calls in the morning.
You going? Well, I don't know. I guess. You? Well, I promised Maggie I'd take down the storm windows.
Agreements to meet for beers later, and the receivers compressed very slowly to muffle the guilty click. Those who wept, mostly women, did so in the front room, on plush sofas and leather ottomans. Natalie's brother was there, shaking in the arms of his mother, as she rocked him and cried silently, patting down his dark hair. Sweet kid, to cry so openly. I'd never seen such a thing. Ladies came by with paper plate offerings of food, but mother and son just shook their heads no. My mother fluttered around them like a manic blue jay, but they took no notice, and soon she was off to her circle of friends. Mr. Keene stood in a corner with Mr. Nash, both of them smoking silently. Recent evidence of Natalie was still scattered around the room. A small gray sweater folded over the back of a chair, a pair of tennis shoes with bright blue laces by the door. On one of the bookshelves sat a spiral notebook with a unicorn on the front. In a magazine rack was a dog-eared copy of A Wrinkle in Time. I was rotten. I didn't approach the family, didn't announce myself. I walked through their home and I spied, my head down in my beer like a shamed ghost. I saw Katie Lacey, my old best friend from Calhoun High, in her own well-coiffed circle, the exact mirror of my mother's group, minus 20 years. She kissed me on the cheek when I approached.
"Heard you were in town, was hoping you'd phone," she said, wrinkling her thinly plucked eyebrows at me, then passing me off to the three other women, all of whom crowded in to give me limp hugs. All of whom had been my friends at one point, I suppose. We exchanged condolences and murmured about how sad this was. Angie Papermaker, née Knightley, looked like she was still battling the bulimia that had whittled her down in high school. Her neck was as thin and ropey as an old woman's. Mimi, a spoiled rich girl, Daddy owned acres of chicken lots down in Arkansas, who'd never liked me much, asked about Chicago and then immediately turned to talk to tiny little Tish, who had decided to hold my hand in a comforting but peculiar gesture. Angie announced to me that she had a 5-year-old daughter. Her husband was at home with his gun watching over her.
"It's going to be a long summer for the little ones," Tish murmured. "I think everyone's keeping their babies under lock and key."
I thought about the girls I'd seen outside the funeral, not much older than Natalie, and wondered why their parents weren't worried.
"You have kids, Camille?"
Angie asked in a voice as thin as her body.
"I don't even know if you're married."
"No and no," I said, and took a slurp of my beer, flashing an image of Angie vomiting at my house after school, emerging from the bathroom pink and triumphant. Curry was wrong. Being an insider here was more distracting than useful.
"Ladies, you can't hide the out-of-towner all night."
I turned to see one of my mother's friends, Jackie O'Neill, née O'Keefe, who'd clearly just had a facelift. Her eyes were still puffy, and her face was moist and red and stretched, as if she was an angry baby squeezing out of the womb. Diamonds flashed on her tanned fingers, and she smelled of juicy fruit and talc when she hugged me. The evening was feeling too much like a reunion, and I was feeling too much like a kid again. I hadn't even dared to pull out my notebook with my mother still here, shooting me warning glances.
"Baby girl, you look so pretty,"
Jackie purred. She had a melon of a head, covered with overbleached hair and a leering smile. Jackie was catty and shallow, but she was always completely herself. She also was more at ease with me than my own mother. It was Jackie, not Adora, who slipped me my first box of tampons, winking that I should phone her if I needed instructions, and Jackie, who'd always teased me merrily about boys. Small, huge gestures.
"How are you, darling? Your mama didn't tell me you were in town, but your mama isn't talking to me right now. I disappointed her again somehow. You know how that goes. I know, you know."
She let out a rocky smoker's laugh and squeezed my arm. I assumed she was drunk.
"I probably forgot to send her a card for something," she babbled on, over-gesturing with the hand that held a glass of wine. "Or maybe the gardener I recommended didn't please her."
"I heard you're doing a story about the girls." "That's just rough."
Her conversation was so bumpy and abrupt, it took me a minute to process everything. By the time I started to speak, she was caressing my arm and staring at me with wet eyes.
"Camille, baby, it's been so damn long since I've seen you. And now,
I look at you and I see you when you were the same age as those girls. And I just feel so sad. So much has gone wrong. I can't make sense of it.
A tear trailed down her cheek.
Look me up, okay? We can talk.
I left the Keene house with no quotes. I was already tired of talking, and I'd said very little. I called the Keens later, after I'd had more to drink, a to-go cup of vodka from their stash, and was safely segregated by phone lines. Then I explained myself and what I would write. It didn't go well. Here's what I filed that night. In tiny Wind Gap, Missouri, posters pleading for the return of 10-year-old Natalie Jane Keene were still hanging as they buried the little girl on Tuesday. A vibrant funeral service at which the priest spoke of forgiveness and redemption did little to calm nerves or heal wounds. That's because the healthy, sweet-faced young girl was the second victim of what police presumed to be a serial killer. A serial killer who's targeting children. All the little ones here are sweethearts, said local farmer Ronald J. Kamens, who assisted in the search for Keene. I can't imagine why this is happening to us. Keene's strangled body was discovered May 14th, crammed into a space between two buildings on Wind Gap's main street. We will miss her laughter, said Jeannie Keene, 52, mother of Natalie. We will miss her tears. Mostly, we will miss Natalie. This, however, is not the first tragedy Wind Gap, located in the boot heel of the state, has withstood. Last August 27th, 9-year-old Ann Nash was found in an area creek, also strangled. She had been bicycling just a few blocks to visit a friend when she was abducted the night before. Both victims reportedly had their teeth removed by the killer. The murders have left the 5-person Wind Gap police force baffled. Lacking experience in such brutal crimes, they have elicited help from the Kansas City Homicide Division, which has sent an officer trained in the psychological profiling of murderers. Residents of the town, population 2,120, are, however, sure of one thing. The person responsible for the slayings is killing with no particular motive. There is a man out there looking for babies to kill, says Ann's father, Bob Nash, 41, a chair salesman. There's no hidden drama here, no secrets. Someone just killed our little girl. The removal of the teeth has remained a point of mystery, and clues thus far have been minimal. Local police have declined to comment. Until these murders are resolved, Wind Gap protects its own. A curfew is in effect, and neighborhood watches have sprung up over this once quiet town. The residents also try to heal themselves. I don't want to talk to anyone, says Jeannie Keene. I just want to be left alone. We all want to be left alone. Hack work. You don't need to tell me that. Even as I emailed Curry the file, I was already regretting nearly everything about it. Stating that police presumed the murders were committed by a serial killer was a stretch. Vickery never said anything of the sort. The first Jeannie Keene quote I stole from her eulogy. The second I yanked from the vitriol she spewed at me when she realized my phone condolences were a front. She knew I planned to dissect her girl's murder, lay it out on butcher paper for strangers to chew on. We all want to be left alone, she yelped. We buried our baby today. Shame on you. A quote, nonetheless. A quote I needed, since Vickery was shutting me out. Curry thought the piece was solid. Not great, mind you, but a solid start. He even left in my over-fried line, a serial killer who's targeting children. That should have been cut. I knew it myself, but I craved the dramatic padding. He must have been drunk when he read it. He ordered a larger feature on the families, soon as I could scrape it together. Another chance to redeem myself. I was lucky. It looked like the Chicago Daily Post might have Wind Gap to ourselves for a bit longer. A congressional sex scandal was unraveling delightfully, destroying not just one austere House member, but three,
two of them women. Lurid, juicy stuff. More importantly, there was a serial killer stalking a more glamorous city, Seattle. Amid the fog and coffee houses, someone was carving up pregnant women, opening their bellies, and arranging the contents in shocking tableaus for his own amusement. Thus, it was our good fortune that reporters for this type of thing were out of commission. There was just me, left wretched in my childhood bed. I slept late into Wednesday, sweaty sheets and blankets pulled over my head, woke several times to phones ringing, the maid vacuuming outside my door, a lawnmower. I was desperate to remain asleep, but the day kept bobbing through. I kept my eyes closed and imagined myself back in Chicago on my rickety slice of a bed in my studio apartment facing the brick back of a supermarket. I had a cardboard dresser purchased at that supermarket when I moved in 4 years ago, and a plastic table on which I ate from a set of weightless yellow plates and bent tinny flatware. I worried that I hadn't watered my lone plant, a slightly yellow fern I'd found by my neighbor's trash. Then I remembered I'd tossed the dead thing out 2 months ago. I tried to imagine other images from my life in Chicago, my cubicle at work, my superintendent who still didn't know my name, the dull green Christmas lights the supermarket had yet to take down, a scattering of friendly acquaintances who probably hadn't noticed I'd been gone. I hated being in Wind Gap, but home held no comfort either. I pulled a flask of warm vodka from my duffel bag and got back in bed. Then, sipping, I assessed my surroundings. I'd expected my mother to pave over my bedroom as soon as I'd left the house, but it looked exactly as it was more than a decade before. I regretted what a serious teenager I'd been. There were no posters of pop stars or favorite movies, no girlish collections of photos or corsages. Instead, there were paintings of sailboats, proper pastel pastorals, a portrait of Eleanor Roosevelt. The latter was particularly strange, since I'd known little about Mrs. Roosevelt, except that she was good, which at the time, I suppose, was enough. Given my druthers now, I'd prefer a snapshot of Warren Harding's wife, the Duchess, who recorded the smallest offenses in a little red notebook and avenged herself accordingly. Today, I like my first ladies with a little bite. I drank more vodka. There was nothing I wanted to do more than be unconscious again, wrapped in black, gone away. I was raw. I felt swollen with potential tears, like a water balloon filled to burst, begging for a pinprick. Wind Gap was unhealthy for me. This home was unhealthy for me. A quiet knock at the door, little more than a rattling gust. Yes? I tucked my glass of vodka to the side of the bed. Camille? It's your mother. Yes? I brought you some lotion. I walked to the door a bit blurrily, the vodka giving me that first necessary layer to deal with this particular place on this particular day. I'd been good about booze for 6 months, but nothing counted here. Outside my door, my mother hovered, peering in warily as if it were the trophy room of a dead child. Close. She held out a large, pale green tube. It has vitamin E. I picked it up this morning. My mother believes in the palliative effects of vitamin E, as if slathering enough on will make me smooth and flawless again. It hasn't worked yet. Thank you. Her eyes scanned across my neck, my arms, my legs, all bared by the lone T-shirt I'd worn to bed. Then back with a frown to my face. She sighed and shook her head slightly. Then she just stood there. Was the funeral very hard on you, Mama? Even now, I couldn't resist making a small conversational offering. It was. So much was similar. That little casket. It was hard for me, too, I nudged. I was actually surprised how hard. I miss her. Still. Isn't that weird?
It would be weird if you didn't. She's your sister. It's almost as painful as losing a child, even though you were so young.
Downstairs, Alan was whistling elaborately, but my mother seemed not to hear. I didn't care much for that open letter Jeannie Keene read, she continued. It's a funeral, not a political rally. And why were they all dressed so informally? I thought the letter was nice. It was heartfelt, I said. Didn't you read anything at Marion's funeral?
No, no. I could barely stand, much less give speeches. I can't believe you can't remember these things, Camille. I'd think you'd be embarrassed to have forgotten so much.
I was only 13 when she died, Mama. Remember? I was young. Nearly 20 years ago. Can that be right?
Yes, well, enough.
Is there anything you'd like to do today? The roses are in bloom at Daly Park, if you'd like a walk. I should go over to the police station.
Don't say that while you're staying here, she snapped. Say you have errands to run or friends to see.
I have errands to run.
Fine. Enjoy.
She padded away down the plush corridor, and I heard the stairs creak quickly downward. I washed up in a cool, shallow bath, lights off, another glass of vodka balanced on the side of the tub, then dressed and entered the hallway. The house was silent, as silent as its century-old structure would allow. I heard a fan whirring in the kitchen as I stood outside to make sure no one was there. Then I slipped in, grabbed a bright green apple, and bit into it as I walked out of the house. The sky was cloudless. Outside on the porch, I saw a changeling. A little girl with her face aimed intently at a huge 4-foot dollhouse, fashioned to look exactly like my mother's home. Long blonde hair drifted in disciplined rivulets down her back, which was to me. As she turned, I realized it was the girl I'd spoken to at the edge of the woods, the girl who'd been laughing with her friends outside Natalie's funeral, the prettiest one.
Emma?
I asked. And she laughed.
Naturally. Who else would be playing on Adora's front porch with a little Adora house?
The girl was in a childish checked sundress, matching straw hat by her side. She looked entirely her age, 13, for the first time since I'd seen her. Actually, no. She looked younger now. Those clothes were more appropriate for a 10-year-old. She scowled when she saw me assessing her.
I wear this for Adora. When I'm home, I'm her little doll.
And when you're not?
I'm other things. You're Camille. You're my half-sister. Adora's first daughter, before Marion. You're pre and I'm post. You didn't recognize me.
I've been away too long. And Adora stopped sending out Christmas photos 5 years ago.
Stopped sending them to you, maybe. We still take the dang pictures. Every year, Adora buys me a red and green checked dress just for the occasion. And as soon as we're done, I throw it in the fire.
She plucked a footstool the size of a tangerine from the dollhouse's front room and held it up to me.
Needs repolstering now. Adora changed her color scheme from peach to yellow. She promised me she'd take me to the fabric store so I can make new coverings to match. This dollhouse is my fancy.
She almost made it sound natural. My fancy. The words floated out of her mouth sweet and round like butterscotch, murmured with just a tilt of her head. But the phrase was definitely my mother's. Her little doll. Learning to speak just like Adora.
Looks like you do a very good job with it, I said, and motioned a weak wave goodbye. Thank you, she said.
Her eyes focused on my room in the dollhouse. A small finger poked the bed.
I hope you enjoy your stay here,
she murmured into the room, as if she were addressing a tiny Camille no one could see. I found Chief Vickery banging the dent out of a stop sign at the corner of 2nd and Ely, a quiet street of small houses a few blocks from the police station. He used a hammer, and with each tinny bang, he winced. The back of his shirt was already wet, and his bifocals were slung down to the end of his nose.
"I have nothing to say, Miss Preaker."
Bang. "I know this is an easy thing to resent, Chief Vickery. I didn't really even want this assignment. I was forced into it because I'm from here."
"Haven't been back in years, from what I hear."
Bang. I didn't say anything. I looked at the crabgrass splurting up through a crack in the sidewalk. The miss stung me a bit. I couldn't tell if it was politeness I wasn't accustomed to, or a jab at my unmarried state. A single woman, even a hair over 30, was a queer thing in these parts.
"A decent person would have quit before writing about dead children."
Bang.
"Opportunism, Miss Preaker."
Across the street, an elderly man clutching a carton of milk was shuffling half steps toward a white clapboard house. "I'm not feeling so decent right now, you're right." I didn't mind gingering Vickery along a little bit. I wanted him to like me, not just because it would make my job easier, but because his bluster reminded me of Curry, who I missed. But a little publicity might bring some attention to this case, help get it solved. It's happened before.
"God damn!"
He threw the hammer with a thud on the ground and faced me.
"We already asked for help. Got some special detective from Kansas City down here, off and on for months. And he hasn't been able to figure out one goddamn thing. Says it might be some crazed hitchhiker dropped off the road here, like the looks of the place, and stayed for near on a year. Well, this town ain't that big, and I sure as hell haven't seen anyone looks like they don't belong."
He glanced pointedly at me. "You've got some pretty big woods around here. Pretty dense," I suggested.
"This isn't some stranger, and I would guess you know it."
"I would have thought you'd prefer it to be a stranger." Vickery sighed, lit a cigarette, put his hand around the signpost protectively.
"Hell, of course I would," he said. "But I'm not too dumb myself. Ain't worked no homicide before, but I ain't a goddamn idiot."
I wished then that I hadn't sucked down so much vodka. My thoughts were vaporizing. I couldn't hold on to what he was saying, couldn't ask the right questions. "You think someone from Wind Gap is doing this?"
"No comment."
"Off record, why would someone from Wind Gap kill kids?"
"Got called out one time because Anne had killed a neighbor's pet bird with a stick. She'd sharpened it herself with one of her daddy's hunting knives. Natalie? Hell, her family moved here 2 years ago because she stabbed one of her classmates in the eye with a pair of scissors back in Philadelphia. Her daddy quit his job at some big business just so they could start over in the state where his granddad grew up, in a small town. Like a small town don't come with its own set of problems.
Not the least of which is everyone knows who the bad seeds are."
"Damn straight."
"So you think this could be someone who didn't like the children? These girls specifically? Maybe they had done something to him, and this was revenge?" Vickery pulled at the end of his nose, scratched his mustache. He looked back at the hammer on the ground, and I could tell he was debating whether to pick it up and dismiss me, or keep talking. Just then a black sedan whooshed up next to us, the passenger side window zipping down before the car even stopped. The driver's face, blocked by sunglasses, peered out to look at us.
"Hey, Bill. Thought we were supposed to meet at your office right about now." "Had some work to do."
It was Kansas City. He looked at me, lowering his glasses in a practiced way.
He had a flip of light brown hair that kept dropping over his left eye. Blue. He smiled at me, teeth like perfect chiclets.
Hi there.
He glanced at Vickery, who pointedly bent down to pick up the hammer, then back at me. Hi, I said. I pulled my sleeves down over my hands, balled the ends up in my palms, leaned on one leg.
Well, Bill, want a ride? Or are you a walkin' man? I could pick us up some coffee and meet you there. Don't drink coffee. Something you should have noticed by now. I'll be there in 15 minutes. See if you can make it 10, huh? We're already running late.
Kansas City looked at me one more time.
Sure you don't want a lift, Bill?
Vickery said nothing, just shook his head.
Who's your friend, Bill? I thought I'd met all the pertinent wind-gappers already. Or is it wind-gappians?
He grinned. I stood silent as a schoolgirl, hoping Vickery would introduce me. Bang. Vickery was choosing not to hear. In Chicago, I would have jabbed my hand out, announced myself with a smile, and enjoyed the reaction. Here, I stared at Vickery and stayed mute.
All right, then. See you at the station.
The window zipped back up. The car pulled away.
Is that the detective from Kansas City? I asked.
In answer, Vickery lit another cigarette, walked off. Across the street, the old man had just reached his top step. Chapter 4. Someone had spray-painted blue curlicues on the legs of the water tower at Jacob J. Garrett Memorial Park, and it was left looking oddly dainty, as if it were wearing crochet booties. The park itself, the last place Natalie Keene was seen alive, was vacant. The dirt from the baseball field hovered a few feet above the ground. I could taste it in the back of my throat like tea left brewing too long. The grasses grew tall at the edge of the woods. I was surprised no one had ordered them cut, eradicated like the stones that snagged Ann Nash. When I was in high school, Garrett Park was the place everyone met on weekends to drink beer or smoke pot or get jerked off 3 feet into the woods. It was where I was first kissed, at age 13, by a football player with a pack of chaw tucked down in his gums. The rush of the tobacco hit me more than the kiss. Behind his car I vomited wine cooler with tiny glowing slices of fruit.
James Capisi was here.
I turned around to face a blonde, buzz-cut boy of about 10, holding a fuzzy tennis ball. James Capisi? I asked.
My friend. He was here when she got Natalie, the kid said. James saw her. She was wearing her nightgown. They were playing frisbee over by the woods, and she took Natalie. It would have been James, but he decided to stay here on the field, so Natalie was the one right by the trees. James was out here because of the sun. He's not supposed to be in the sun because his mom's got skin cancer, but he does anyway.
Or he did. The boy bounced the tennis ball, and a puff of dirt floated up around him. He doesn't like the sun anymore?
He doesn't like nothing no more.
Because of Natalie? He shrugged belligerently.
Because James is a pussy.
The kid looked me up and down, then suddenly threw the ball at me hard. It hit my hip and bounced off. He blurted out a little laugh.
Sorry.
He scrambled after the ball, dove on top of it dramatically, then leapt up and hurled it against the ground. It bounced about 10 feet in the air, then dribbled to a stop. I'm not sure I understood what you said. Who was wearing a nightgown? I kept my eye on the bouncing ball.
The woman who took Natalie?
Wait, what do you mean? The story I'd heard was that Natalie had been playing here with friends who left to go home one by one, and that she was assumed to have been abducted somewhere along her short walk home.
James saw the woman take Natalie. It was just the two of them, and they were playing frisbee, and Natalie missed and it went into the grasses by the woods, and the woman just reached out and grabbed her. Then they were gone, and James ran home, and he don't come out since.
Then how do you know what happened?
I visited him once. He told me. I'm his buddy.
Does James live around here?
Fuck him. I might go to my grandma's for the summer anyway, in Arkansas. Better'n here.
The boy threw the ball at the chain-link fence outlining the baseball diamond, and it lodged there, rattling the metal.
You from here?
He began kicking dirt in the air.
Yeah, I used to be. I don't live here anymore. I'm visiting.
I tried again. Does James live around here?
You in high school?
His face was deeply tanned. He looked like a baby marine.
No. College?
His chin was wet with spit.
Older. I gotta go.
He hopped away backward, yanked the ball out of the fence like a bad tooth, turned around and looked at me again, waggled his hips in a nervous dance.
I gotta go.
He threw the ball toward the street where it bounced off my car with an impressive thunk. He ran after it and was gone. I looked up Capisi, Janelle, in a magazine-thin phone book at Wingap's lone fast stop. Then I filled a big mouth with strawberry pop and drove to 3617 Holmes. The Capisi Holmes sat on the edge of the low-rent section to the far east of town, a cluster of broken-down two-bedroom houses, most of whose inhabitants work at the nearby pig factory farm, a private operation that delivers almost 2% of the country's pork. Find a poor person in Windgap, and they'll almost always tell you they work at the farm, and so did their old man. On the breeding side, there are piglets to be clipped and crated, sows to be impregnated and penned, manure pits to be managed. The killing side's worse. Some employees load the pigs, forcing them down the gangway where stunners await. Others grab the back legs, fasten the catch around them, release the animal to be lifted, squealing and kicking upside down. They cut the throats with pointy slaughter knives, the blood spattering thick as paint onto the tile floors. Then on to the scalding tank. The constant screams, frantic, metallic squeals, drive most of the workers to wear earplugs, and they spend their days in a soundless rage. At night they drink and play music, loud. The local bar, Gila's, serves nothing pork-related, only chicken tenders, which are presumably processed by equally furious factory workers in some other crappy town. For the sake of full disclosure, I should add that my mother owns the whole operation and receives approximately $1.2 million in profits from it annually. She lets other people run it. A tomcat was yowling on the Capisi's front porch, and as I walked toward the house, I could hear the din of a daytime talk show. I banged on the screen door and waited. The cat rubbed up against my legs. I could feel its ribs through my pants. I banged again, and the TV switched off. The cat stalked under the porch swing and cried. I traced the word yelp on my right palm with a fingernail and knocked again.
Mom?
A child's voice at the open window. I walked over, and through the dust of the screen could see a thin boy with dark curls and gaping eyes.
Hi there. I'm sorry to bug you. Are you James? What do you want?
Hi, James. I'm sorry to bother you. Were you watching something good?
Are you the police?
I'm trying to help figure out who hurt your friend. Can I talk to you? He didn't leave, just traced a finger along the window ledge. I sat down on the swing at the far end, away from him. My name's Camille. A friend of yours told me what you'd seen. A boy with real short blonde hair?
Dee. Is that his name? I saw him at the park, the same park where you were playing with Natalie.
She took her. No one believes me. I'm not scared. I just need to stay in the house is all. My mom has cancer. She's sick.
That's what Dee said. I don't blame you. I hope I didn't scare you coming by like this. He began scraping an overlong fingernail down the screen. The clicking sound made my ears itch.
You don't look like her. If you looked like her, I'd call the police. Or I'd shoot you.
What did she look like? He shrugged his shoulders.
I've said it already, 100 times.
One more time?
She was old.
Old like me?
Old like a mother.
What else?
She was wearing a white bed dress with white hair. She was just all white, but not like a ghost. That's what I keep saying.
White like how?
Just like she'd never been outside before.
And the woman grabbed Natalie when she went toward the woods? I asked it in the same coaxing voice my mother used on favored waitstaff.
I'm not lying.
Of course not. The woman grabbed Natalie while y'all were playing?
Real fast, he nodded. Natalie was walking in the grass to find the frisbee, and I saw the woman moving from inside the woods, watching her. I saw her before Natalie did, but I wasn't scared.
Probably not.
Even when she grabbed Natalie, at first I wasn't scared.
But then you were?
No.
His voice trailed off. I wasn't. James, could you tell me what happened when she grabbed Natalie?
She pulled Natalie against her, like she was hugging her. And then she looked up at me. She stared at me.
The woman did?
Yeah. She smiled at me. For a second I thought it might be all right. But she didn't say anything, and then she stopped smiling. She put her finger to her lips to be quiet. And then she was gone into the woods. With Natalie.
He shrugged again.
I've already told all this before.
To the police?
First to my mom, then the police. My mom made me. But the police didn't care.
Why not?
They thought I was lying. But I wouldn't make that up. It's stupid.
Did Natalie do anything while this was happening?
No. She just stood there. I don't think she knew what to do.
Did the woman look like anyone you'd seen before?
No. I told you.
He stepped away from the screen then, began looking over his shoulder into the living room.
Well, I'm sorry to bother you. Maybe you should have a friend come by.
Keep you company. He shrugged again, chewed on a fingernail. You might feel better if you get outside.
I don't want to. Anyway, we have a gun.
He pointed back over his shoulder at a pistol balanced on the arm of a couch next to a half-eaten ham sandwich.
Jesus.
You sure you should have that out, James? You don't want to use that. Guns are very dangerous.
Not so dangerous. My mom doesn't care.
He looked at me straight on for the first time.
You're pretty. You have pretty hair.
Thank you.
I've got to go.
Okay. Be careful, James.
That's what I'm doing.
He sighed purposefully and walked away from the window. A second later, I heard the TV squabble on again.
There are 11 bars in Windgap. I went to one I didn't know. Sensors, which must have blossomed during some flash of 80s idiocy, judging by the neon zigzags on the wall and the mini dance floor in its center. I was drinking a bourbon and scribbling down my notes from the day when K.C. Law plopped down in the cushioned seat opposite me. He rattled his beer on the table between us.
I thought reporters weren't supposed to talk to minors without permission.
He smiled, took a gulp. James's mother must have